So I thought tonight I would speak a little bit about what is sometimes called in the Buddhist tradition personality types, and then take some questions. The construct of personality types in Buddhism has to do with what are called the three root defilements, is the common translation. I never liked the translation defilement for the obvious reasons, is that it sounds so incredibly judgmental. The word that is the original word in Pali, the language of the original Buddhist text, is klesa. In Sanskrit, it's klesha. And a more literal translation of it is torment of the mind. And this, I think, is something we can all get behind. You know, we know that when we are completely lost in a force like jealousy or greed or hatred or fear, that we're actually in torment. And that's the import of that statement. So we have torments of the mind, sometimes many of them, which are said to be rooted in three basic conditioned tendencies. The first of these is grasping or greed. It's the mind state that has us try to hold on, to possess, to keep change from happening. It's kind of wearying even to talk about, you know, to keep change from happening. It's somehow feeling that we are not enough, we do not have enough, that we're bereft, we're deficient, and trying to get and have and hold and keep people or objects or experiences or something that will satisfy us, that will make us feel fulfilled. And another side of that tendency is not wanting to open to or admit either the truth of change or the suffering, the discontent, the dis-ease that can happen in any given day. In some ways, this translates to a strange kind of optimism that's very removed. It's almost narrow-minded, not being willing to face the complexity, the intricacy of so many things that come our way. And the Buddha talked about what happens when it's almost like our personality constellates around this kind of tendency. It doesn't mean that's the only problem we have, but it is a predominant mode of being. It doesn't necessarily mean at all that you're a greedy person, but rather your immediate tendency would be to see the pleasant and try to keep it. So they say, for example, that if this kind of grasping is your primary tendency, you'll walk into a room and you'll see what you like. So I like what that person's wearing, or I wonder where they got that. Maybe I could get that too. And look at these incredible light fixtures. Wow. You know, wouldn't that brighten up my living room? You know, and what a fantastic choice for that color over there, that gray. It's like, it's so dignified. Isn't that great? So that is just naturally what your eye falls upon. I also sometimes describe that type of person as the person who'll sit in a meeting and somebody will bring up an element of discord or some problem, some dilemma facing the group, and that person will say, "It'll all work out." And sometimes you sit there and you think, "How? How's it all going to work out?" But they see the world in that way. My friend Joseph Goldstein is a primary and self-confessed example of a greedy or grasping type. And again, it doesn't mean he's a greedy person, because he's not at all. but this is just how he tends to see the world. So once, a couple of years ago, after United Airlines was really having some difficulty, but before it filed for bankruptcy, I said to him, because we both have all of our frequent flyer miles on United, I said to him, Joseph, well, let me give you a little more background. Joseph's quite tall. He's about 6'3". And so he relies on using those frequent flyer miles to upgrade his flight so he can sit in a higher class cabin so that he doesn't suffer so much from being all scrunched up. So I said, Joseph, what are you going to do if United goes under before you can use all your frequent flyer miles? And he said to me, it's not going to happen. And I thought, oh, okay. And about 15 minutes later, I thought, how does he know that? So there is that tendency of mind. We see it, of course, in less pleasant manifestations all around the world. We see what happens when we refuse to open to suffering, when we refuse to pay attention, when we are fixated on getting what we want, when we have that kind of one-track mind. The word fixation, I think, is very interesting in Buddhist teaching because it really does mean having the world shrink down into what we want to get or what we want to keep or what we don't yet have and feel we need. And it's remarkable how much we miss, which is everything. You know, that very famous saying, I thought of it last night, actually, listening to Ramdas speak, because I think it's actually in Be Here Now, where it says, in India, they say that when a pickpocket meets a saint, they only see the saint's pockets. You know, when we have a fixation, we see only what we're looking for, or we feel we don't have. And everything else that we might be enjoying, that might be fulfilling us, that might be objects of gratitude, tremendous gratitude for us, we don't even notice them because our world has gotten that small. So that's the tendency of grasping. And then there's the next one, the other root defilement is aversion, which manifests as anger and fear. And I've always found it interesting that in the Buddhist psychology, anger and fear are exactly the same mind state, just in two different forms. Anger is the outflowing, expressive, energized form. Fear is the imploded, frozen, held-in form. But they're exactly the same thing, which is striking out against what's happening, trying to declare it to be untrue. It's a funny kind of control mechanism where we almost think that if we push hard enough, we can make it not so. And there's often a component of shame in there as well. Like, how did I let this happen? Or this must be my fault that this has come to be. So let me try to seize control now. Make it go away. Deny it. There's a, especially in the form of the anger, there's considered to be some really positive elements to it. It is energized. It can, when we're angry, we can say no, we can draw boundaries. There's a kind of integrity to that, to declaring what we feel to be true. But there's also considered to be tremendous negativity to that. In the Buddhist psychology, anger is likened to a forest fire which burns up its own support. And we know that. We can ourselves be just devastated by the anger we carry. And like a forest fire, it can burn wild and maybe leave us in a place very far from where we wanted to be. So that's the other side of it. The people who are so-called angry types, and again, that doesn't mean they're ferocious or violent, you know, people, will be the kinds of people who just will naturally walk into a room and see everything that's wrong, according to them. I don't like what that person's wearing. And what's that gray stuff in the back? You know, like, they could have done better than that. And, you know, what about those light fixtures? Awfully bright, aren't they? You know, and they're kind of grumpy, you know, just as a matter of course. And I often think of them as the kind of person who will sit in a meeting and somebody will bring up some possibility or some challenge, and they'll say, it's not going to work. And you might sit there and think, why not? But it's just that, no, it's not going to happen. It becomes such a tremendous habit of mind to strike out in that way. And then the third type of person, personality type, is one whose personality is sort of wrapped primarily around the quality of delusion. Now, I should say right away that we all, of course, have all three. That's what makes the world go round. That's what makes us suffer. But sometimes there is a more striking characteristic of one rather than the other. And I am a classic deluded type, which is why I like talking about it so much. The state of delusion, which we all fall into, deluded type or not, is a state. The word in Pali is moha, M-O-H-A, and it is translated as being stupefied. It's a state where, you know, not when you're in unfamiliar terrain, but when you're home, wherever you live, and you're driving, and suddenly you think, where am I? Am I still on 122, or did I turn onto 202 already? Where am I? You know, something you should know, but you don't know. That's the state of delusion. It's being in a fog, it's being numb in some way, being cut off from a very vibrant or vital experience of what is actually happening. It's characterized also by not knowing exactly what you feel, not really necessarily being in touch with your inner experience until you hear someone else describe their own response. So that might be the person who walks into the room and doesn't notice much. I'm told that deluded types are the best people to travel with. I once traveled through China and Tibet with another friend of mine who's a self-confessed greedy type. And we would check into, you know, some hotel in China and go up to the room, and she would say to me, do you mind if I take that bed over there? And I'd say, no, that's fine. And then maybe 10 minutes later, I'd say, why did you want that bed? And she'd say, well, it's near the light switch so I can control the light, and the mattress isn't sagging, and the mosquito net doesn't have a hole in it, and it's near the fan so I can control the fan. It's like, I hadn't noticed anything. Really? Look at that. So there's a certain kind of befuddlement to this type. And we all do experience delusion. Actually, my favorite delusion story about myself, it's an older one. I think I've had a more recent one, but I can't remember right now. I was sitting there thinking, what was that story? I can't remember that story. But the one I do remember happened some time ago where I live in Massachusetts part of the time, where the retreat center is, the Insight Meditation Society. I live next door to it. And I'd gone to Cambridge one night to teach a class and then come back fairly late at night. And I just kind of casually noticed that I didn't have that much gas in the car when I you know, shut it down. And then I went to bed, and I woke up in the morning and walked over next door to the retreat center to teach. And I noticed that my car was gone. And I kind of had this confused thought that maybe one of the staff people over at the retreat center had somehow known it needed gas. And they'd taken the car to fill it with gas. So I walked into the staff dining room at the retreat center. And the first person I saw was the person who, if anyone were to have taken the car, it would have been him. So I said to him, "Did you take my car?" And he said, "No, I didn't take your car." And I said, "Well, it's gone." And then this was the killer moment. He looked at me and he said, "Are you sure?" And I thought, "Am I sure? Is it gone? Did I just walk right by it and I didn't see it?" And I said, "I think it's gone." So then I was getting ready to go upstairs to see some people on retreat, and one of the other teachers came in, who's a self-confessed angry type. And I looked at her and I said, "Did you take my car?" And she said, "No, I didn't take your car." And I said, "Well, I think it's gone." And she said, "Well, you know, you probably just lent it to somebody and you don't remember who." And I thought, okay. So then I went upstairs and I was seeing meditators all morning doing interviews. And every once in a while I think, who did I lend my car to? I can't remember who it went to. And then I went downstairs at lunch and I ran into another teacher and I said, "Did you take my car?" And somebody walking by said, "Oh, I know what happened to your car." It was Joseph, actually. He said, "I know what happened to your car. Somebody called me really early in the morning and they had this emergency and they really needed a car. And I knew, you know, yours was the only car they could have and you wouldn't mind. So I told them to take your car." I said, "Oh." But that moment of, am I sure? Who do I lend my car to? That's the moment of delusion that we all experience from time to time. It's born of many different kinds of conditions for all of us, whether or not we would call ourselves a deluded type of person, primarily. It's born often when we're afraid. And we just want to cut off. We want to shut down. We want to wrap ourselves in some kind of cocoon of not knowing, of not noticing. It comes many times when our experience is kind of neutral. When our experience is pleasant, when it's wonderful, the great challenge is to enjoy it without adding that extra thing, which is grasping and holding and trying to possess. And when our experience is painful or unpleasant, the great challenge is to open to it, to be fully present in that moment rather than shutting down and resisting and hating what's happening. And when our experience is neutral, it's just kind of ordinary, the great challenge is not to go to sleep, not to fall into that state of delusion, of confusion, which takes a whole kind of training. I can remember when I was first practicing in this particular school of meditation, where I was living in India in this compound, and we were instructed to try to make a mental note of the most predominant experience we had at any time throughout the day. So every moment was an opportunity to make a mental note. And I noticed when I was walking around this compound, the single most common mental note that I was making was that of waiting. I was just kind of going around saying to myself, waiting, 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 waiting. And then one day I asked myself, what are you waiting for? And I realized I was waiting for something important enough to happen or significant enough to happen or spiritual enough to happen for me to make a mental note of it. I realized that I was living life as though a tape recorder with the pause button on. That's delusion. we just kind of go to sleep because we're not terrifically trained to subtlety. We tend to need something intensely pleasant or intensely unpleasant in order to feel alive. So it's just a breath. It's just a sound. It's just an apple. It's just another cup of tea. We're gone. We fall into that kind of stupefied state. That's delusion. So as I said, you know, it's actually very fun if you read some of the ancient texts like the Visuddhimagga, which is a great commentarial work written a few hundred years after the time of the Buddha. They describe these different personality types and how they, you know, eat and how they wake up in the morning and things like that. You know, and sometimes you can get that sense. It's almost like getting an astrological reading and saying, hey, I'm a Leo, you know, that's why. Sometimes you do get a sense that there's a very strong singular force almost that is very predominant in your personality structure, and sometimes it's just a mix. But regardless, what is also interesting is that mindfulness as a state of mind is considered the antidote for grasping, aversion, and delusion. Mindfulness, by definition, actually, is a quality of awareness that is connected to what's happening without adding to our perception because of holding on or pushing away or going to sleep. And every single moment is a moment where that is a possibility. As the Buddha talked about the world, he talked about our experiencing the world in one of six ways in every moment. That's the five sense doors: seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and what he called the mind door: thoughts, images, emotions. That's our world. And he talked about how we perceive that world in every moment as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. We hear a sound. We feel it to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. We see a sight. We have a feeling, an emotion. It's pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral for a whole variety of different conditions. And then he went on to say, our conditioned tendency when that sound or sight or sensation in the body or whatever is pleasant is to grab. It's to try to hold on and defy the truth of change. And when it's unpleasant, it's either to shrink away in fear or to push away in anger. And when it's neutral, it's to go to sleep. And he went on to say that we have an opportunity in every moment to be free instead of bound to those particular habits of grasping, aversion, and delusion. We can experience the pleasure fully without holding on. We can experience the pain fully with an open heart, with compassion, with wisdom. And we can actually wake up and be more completely alive in all of those neutral moments. So mindfulness is almost like this alchemical agent. What I always found interesting in that example of the Buddha's was that I kind of had the thought that if I meditated hard enough and long enough, everything would flatten out and the highs and lows would go away. And it would all sort of morph into this gray blob. And many people think that. Some people long for that. Many people are afraid of that. But that is actually not what happens. Because we can experience and do experience the pleasure fully, but without the grasping. And the pain fully, because we can't keep it from coming. And we come alive in those neutral experiences. It's a very full experience of all that life has to provide. And it's also said, mindfulness is also said to be like the alchemical agent in terms of the personality types. So if you're perception of the world tends to be dominated by greed or grasping, what you can get, what you need, how you can hold on to the pleasant. And you practice being mindful of that and of your experience. It said that that grasping tendency transforms into faith. Because they share, the grasping and the faith share certain qualities, like a love of life, a willingness to move close to experience things fully, not to be withdrawn and standing away. But faith is experiencing the whole of life, not just wanting the pleasant stuff, with an open heart, with interest, with coming close, with intimacy. And so the grasping is said to transform into faith. And the anger and the fear, the aversion, is said to transform into wisdom. Because there's a lot of intelligence often in that anger. There's a strength, a willingness to go below the surface of things, to name truths that maybe no one else wants to name, to probe, to analyze, to not be gullible and, you know, and just stay on the surface. And so we can have that energy of that kind of demand for clarity and integrity, but without the burning and the kind of distortion that happens when we're lost in anger itself. And even delusion is said to transform to something, which is equanimity or balance of mind. Not the equanimity I had in China, because I didn't notice anything. Like, sure, take that bed. But a balance that comes when we do notice more fully, when we practice what is called wise attention, actually inhabiting our lives, paying attention to what is within us and what is around us, to be more present, and yet to have a kind of ease of being, to have that kind of balance that doesn't get so fretful over all of the trivial assaults we face every day, that doesn't get carried away, doesn't get swept up in a kind of habitual reactiveness. And so that too is said, the delusion too is said to transform, to transmute to the state of equanimity. So there's hope for everybody. I often thought that the word mindfulness was kind of puny, you know, that we needed a word with somewhat more grandeur. I mean, here we are with this invitation anyway to try to cultivate a quality of mind that is said to transform greed into faith and anger into wisdom and dullness or delusion into balance. Sounds pretty great. You know, it sounds really powerful. And yet the other part of what is so special about the state of mindfulness is that it's not remote. It's not that, you know, 18 years of practicing mindfulness will transmute a moment of greed into faith. It's something that happens, something that is accessible, something that is livable right here and now. And so the Buddha said that every moment of mindfulness is a moment of freedom. Do you have any questions or comments? Anything you'd like to talk about?
I have a question related to the idea of transforming. So I kind of follow on the everyone but the delusion. I kind of find sort of panic. You wake up and you go quickly to either one of the other two. Instead of being transmuted into equanimity.
Oh, how funny. The question was about the last thing I said about delusion transmuting into equanimity, and her impression that instead of that, you would wake up and if I understood you correctly, that you would wake up from a state of delusion and become either greedy or angry. Yeah. Which might also be possible. But no, I don't think the delusion transforms in its purified state to greed or anger. That's more what we experience when we're lost. You know, because delusion is also a basis for the development of greed or the development of anger. It's because we don't notice how much things are changing that we feel we can hold on. It's because we don't notice how out of control we are that we strike out against what's happening. And it's often because of delusion that, which is a somewhat uncomfortable state sometimes. You know, sometimes we're in a state of fogginess and being cut off and just sort of lost in that way, and we feel fine about it. You know, that's almost our preference. But sometimes it's uncomfortable and we don't like it. And that's when things sort of build in such a way that we look for a sense of certainty somewhere so as not to feel so alienated, so cut off from what's going on. So the example is sometimes used in the Buddhist texts of person out in the wilderness seeking shelter. And when they find something that they think will provide a kind of shelter or safety, they will hold on to it very, very tightly. So it's just in that way that we sometimes try to hold on to ideas or concepts or opinions in order to mask our delusion, you know, that feeling of not knowing where we are, not being sure of anything. And the story I usually tell about that is when we first moved into the center, the Insight Meditation Society. It was 1976, and we'd gone to see it in late winter of 75, you know, sometime around Christmas time, to try to decide if we were going to buy it or not. And, at the time, it was owned by the Catholic Church, this group called the Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament, and they gave us a tour of this facility, which is pretty big and sprawling. It's got a lot of different wings. The building itself has gone through many incarnations. It was built first as a private home, a mansion, and then it became a nursing home, and so those wings got added, and then the church took it over, and they added more wings and a bowling alley. And so we were going on this tour of the place, Joseph Goldstein, Jack Kornfield, and I, and we came to the wing that had been added when it was a nursing home. And Joseph, who grew up at the Catskills, the Catskill Mountain section of New York State, which is a resort section, walked into that wing and he said, "This place looks just like a hotel in the Catskills," you know, which was a kind of joke he made. And we went on, you know, went to the next wing, and then we made the decision to buy the place. So about, you know, 2 or 3 months later, we moved in, and it was so sprawling that somebody had to make a map to show us, you know, where all these different things were in the bathrooms and this whole thing. And they posted the map on the bulletin board down in the front hallway. And I went downstairs one day, took a look at the map, and on it, underneath that wing, it said the Catskills. And I thought, oh, that's so funny. Joseph made a joke, and this person put it on the map. You know, this will never last. You know, so 28 years later, what do you think that wing is called? The Catskills. So a few years ago, when you first come to IMS, if you want, one of the staff people will take you on a tour of the whole building. So one of my friends was on this tour. He'd never been there before, and he's going around, and they got to that wing, and the staff person said, "And this is called the Catskills." So my friend said, "Why? Why is this called the Catskills?" And the staff member went into a very lengthy explanation of how this was the wing that lied closest to the Catskill Mountains, and, which actually is not true. It lies furthest from the Catskill Mountains. But he had a very elaborate explanation about all that. So my friend came to me and he said, I understand you named the wing because of its proximity to the Catskill Mountains. And I thought, why in the world would we name a wing of this building because of its proximity to the Catskill Mountains? You know, it was a joke. Joseph made a joke. But that's how things are, you know. Not knowing is not a very comfortable state sometimes. And so we build all these levels of, you know, oh, it's because of this and it's because of that. And then, you know, and then it becomes solid, you know, and 27 years later, it's a legend. You know, that's how it happens.
There's the befuddlement, there's the confusion and the not knowing, but then there's the not knowing anyway. So then, I guess, I don't know my question. Well, another question I have then. State where everything's very present, like I really notice these sweaty patterns and your toes moving and all of this. But then there's a state where I feel like I can be watching all of that happening, and it's I'm in a way I'm really aware, but in a general way, but not very specifically aware at all. Can you say
I think I can speak to both, actually, maybe. The question was about sometimes being aware of great specificity and detail, and sometimes being aware but not in such a precise form. And really, either is fine. And we may have that kind of shift all of the time. More the question is one's openness to experience, which may come through sometimes in that kind of precision or minuteness, and it may be more general but still genuinely present. Mm-hmm. You know?
But how do you know when the confusion is befuddlement or the unknowing or when it's just what is?
How do you know when the confusion is befuddlement or when it is just what is? Well, to go back to your unspoken question first, there's a kind of not knowing that's not confusion. It's not that state of being stupefied. It's the truth of things. That, you know, we're moving into the unknown all of the time. That is how things actually are. But that isn't that same feeling of being cut off and being wrapped in this cloud and, you know, and having that, that sense of fearfulness, really, almost, you know, the agitation of like, I don't know what's going on, or the smothering nature of it. It's, I think there's almost a kind of crystal clarity to like, we're entering the unknown all of the time. Let's not make assumptions about what might be is very different. And another way of framing the last question you asked is, you may, what you're mindful of, what you're working to be mindful of in any given moment might be that confusion, because it may be the most predominant thing that's going on. And so shining the light of awareness on that is what you would want to do. In other words, you're not completely lost in it, because a part of your mind is outside of it being aware of it. I think Ram Dass talked about that last night too, actually. He said something like that. That part of your being is aware of what's going on, rather than just kind of wrapped in it and swirled around in it and tossed about by it. You know, and that becomes almost like the steady state after a while. That's really one's refuge.
How would you block your ideas about being able to manifest
So is what you're asking, is do I believe that if one said everything is going to be okay with some verve or conviction, that it might actually be so? Is that the question?
I don't think we have developed that very well.
Uh-huh.
I think it's potential. Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I guess I just see things differently than that. You know, I think we can be okay no matter what is happening. And I think there's a quality of wholeness or almost like intactness we can experience no matter what is happening. But I don't have the belief system that even a very deep, not at all a superficial, but a very deep positing of the world as being okay is going to make it so. You know, I have much... You can be more specific in what you're trying to manifest, and sometimes it happens, you know. And it doesn't happen accidentally. It happens in part because of the effort what one might put in. I just think there's a fine line between that and having a sense that we can somehow assume control and then being devastated when we can't. You know, it's like all the people who feel... that they've caused their illness, you know, which is not to say that there's nothing we can do in terms of... And sometimes they can, sometimes they can't, you know. But, you know, to finish what I was saying, like the, you know, that it's not to say that you didn't necessarily cause your illness, you know, by some bad kind of thinking, you know. Doesn't mean to, I don't mean to imply that our mind states have nothing to do with our, you know, state of health or our state of being. But knowing that and feeling that and working with that and being ardent about that is very different than what sometimes happens with people where they feel that's an absolute truth and that it is their fault. You know, they had the wrong kind of thinking, the wrong kind of emotional state. You know, so it's kind of like that. It's in that area that I would hesitate to kind of say that. You know, it doesn't mean we're ineffectual or that there's nothing we can do, but we're so bound and determined to control anyway, you know. I mean, that's so much a part of our conditioning or our makeup that I think, you know, you just have to kind of look for that. If there's some element of that coming into one's effort, you know, and one's striving and one's working and trying to make a difference. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The question was about opening one's heart and experiencing a greater intensity of pleasure and pain in life. And sometimes that openness, I'll paraphrase what you said, you know, leading to a kind of vulnerability that sometimes you just need to leave aside. And you want to cocoon yourself with not knowing so much. Well, first I'd say it's not only that I don't think it's only the development of open-heartedness. I don't think that open-heartedness only leads to an increased experience of pleasure and pain, but it's all those neutral moments when we're ordinarily asleep that we actually can feel connected. And that, in a way, is also a kind of buffer, because there's that sense of being present and more fully experiencing my hand touching this, you know, the coldness of the tape recorder, a breath. You know, so it's not just waking up in those moments. And I think that provides a kind of balance in and of itself. And also, it's not just that we're developing that kind of acute sensitivity, although that is certainly part of what develops. There is also wisdom or perspective or balance that is part of it. Balance or equanimity being the, it's almost like the articulation of a kind of wisdom. Because so much of the time we turn away from the suffering, or we are disgruntled by somebody expressing it, because something is resonating inside of us. We feel responsible for changing it sometimes. We want to fix it. We feel inadequate. It brings up a sense of helplessness or powerlessness. We don't like that. You know, there are lots of ways in which it's not so much the hearing of the story or the empathy for the person. It's some reaction that's happening inside of us that's so draining. And the more balance we have, the more we aren't necessarily dominated by those reactions. You know, the classic example for equanimity in the Buddhist texts, I just had this incredible deja vu that I've said this before here, which I probably have, is a parent whose child is now an adult. And the parent is needing to relate to the child with a kind of balance and letting go. You know, which doesn't mean they don't care and they don't love them and they don't want them to be a certain way, but there's also an acknowledgement that this child is now an adult and they're making their own decisions, they're making their own choices, that happiness and suffering will often ensue from those choices, and the parent is not in control of that person's actions. You know, so I used to read this all the time in the Buddhist texts, and I used to think, oh, what nice families they had in those days, you know, like where the parents let go appropriately at just the right time, you know, and like, but it's like that, you know, that state of equanimity or balance where we care deeply, but the next step isn't like, I've got to fix it, I've got to make it go away. It's not coldness at all, but it's wisdom. It's like, yeah, you know, it's a complicated life. You know, things happen. It's really, it's a big life. We have to do the best we can. Sometimes it doesn't work right away, you know. All of that kind of understanding that will give us a bigger perspective. The question was, is it important to understand which personality type you might be, or is it just enough to just kind of notice the characteristics and to see them? Certainly it's not important to understand what personality type you might be. I have found it, it's so obvious with me, you know, that I found it kind of charming in a way. I've been spending increasing amounts of time in New York City, and my friends tease me that I like to be in New York City so much because the streets are numbered, you know, so I can find my way around, because usually I can't. It's like, where am I? And I have found it actually sometimes leads to a kind of forgiveness of others, where I can recognize, oh, you know, that wasn't like so much a personal attack. You know, no, that's not, that idea's not going to work. But that's their habitual way of being. You know, so I think when it comes easily, it can be interesting. But since we all have all three, no doubt, the most important thing, I think, is to recognize the tendency, to recognize the quality or the characteristic of that mind state when it arises, you know, to see that you're shutting down, you know, and saying no before you've even heard the rest of the sentence, maybe, or you don't want to look at the downside of something or the unpleasantness of something, and to realize what that is, you know, right then. Is somebody in the back there? Yeah. The first part of the question I think I can answer better than the other, you know, since that's a different system. But the question was about do the five hindrances correlate to the three root defilements and the personality types? And certainly, you know, the five hindrances being grasping, aversion, sleepiness, restlessness, and doubt are in a way manifestations of the root defilements. If you look at any of them, you will certainly see delusion in all of them. And you will see, well, grasping and aversion are their own. And elements of restlessness, sleepiness is, you know, an awful lot of delusion and sometimes some anger, you know, pushing away. We don't really want to look at something. It's why one of the antidotes to sleepiness is courage. And restlessness or agitation of mind can have strong elements of grasping or aversion. One of the ways restlessness powerfully manifests is in planning, which is often grasping, you know, like, first I'll do this, then I'll do that, and then I'll accomplish that, and then that'll happen, then I'll, you know, and then, or in guilt, looking back at the past, you know, and ruminating, I shouldn't have done that, and that was horrible, and I'm so terrible, and, you know, which is aversion. And so you can see the building blocks of those states as being the three root defilements. Mm-hmm. The question was about, when Ramdas spoke last night, he talked about our souls, and could I say something about that in terms of Buddhist teaching? Sometimes we teach together these days, Ramdas and I, or Krishnadas, and Ramdas and I are often doing dialogues about that, and he's often teasing me. Because the soul as a word or a concept isn't something you find in Buddhist teaching. The schema or the model that he's using, you know, can be translated in another way. It's like when I was just saying before that when we're aware in the sense of mindfulness, which is a particular kind of awareness, it's not like being aware resentfully, you know, or aware hating ourselves for what we're experiencing. It's defined as a quality of awareness that's not adding greed, hatred, or delusion to what's going on. So that particular awareness is free. And we say that mindfulness can go anywhere. Sometimes we say that mindfulness doesn't take the shape of what it's watching. So you can be mindful of greed and mindful of grief and mindful of joy and mindful of sorrow and you know, the mindfulness isn't ruined by the object of mindfulness being a very unpleasant state. And it's actually not improved by the object being a glorious state. You know, you can almost see mindfulness as being very spacious and open, and therefore able to accommodate everything. You know, sometimes we say, well, I couldn't practice meditation because it was too noisy. Well, guess what? You know, you can be mindful of the noise. Or I couldn't practice because I had too many thoughts. Well, you can be mindful of the thinking. You know, so there's no circumstance that thwarts mindfulness. Mindfulness can go anywhere. And if you're, this is kind of bad Buddhism, but if you're identifying more, I'm trying to think of a better way of saying it, but I can't at the moment. If you're identifying more with the awareness rather than the state, like say you're angry or you're confused, but you're mindful of it, and it's almost like your being is more predominantly in the mindfulness than in the state of confusion, then I think that's what he was meaning by soul. It's that capacity for awareness, for openness, for freedom that exists in any situation. Ramdas had this schema. He's talking about three levels of reality. For those of you who weren't there, who haven't heard him lately, the first is ego, you know, and that's our habitual reactions. It's just being driven in the ordinary way. The second is what he called soul. And the third is what he called number three, which in some systems might be God or divinity, and, you know, not in all systems. You know, so he doesn't seem to be in the mood to name it, you know. So I think that's kind of the equivalent of what he's saying. You know, we don't have to land so much in, oh, this happened and that happened and that happened and that happened, and I didn't like that and I wanted more of that. But rest more in that sense of awareness of everything that's going on.
Mindful I am, the more I notice how much I grasp and I avoid, and then I start trying to grasp after the state of mindfulness because I want to avoid less, and I get more freaked out about how incredible I am. So I start avoiding, you know, like someone was talking about going out into the world not wanting to go out and have a cocoon. For me, it's more, the more mindful I am and conscious I am, the more I realize how fucking crazy I am. You know what I mean? And I'm trying to, like, have, you know, in some ways I've been, you know, doing this for 8 years, and I was like telling my husband today, like, I'm just not very conscious, and he's like, yes, you are, of course you are. The fact that you're upset about this means how conscious you really are, because, you know, people don't usually think about these things. But I just wonder, because there is a profound sort of funny aspect of that that does make me laugh, but how do you kind of just open to that? And I know in our culture there's a lot of self-hatred, and I feel that sometimes, like just the yuckiness of being human.
So the question was, I'm repeating the question not because you can't hear it, but for the tape. Basically, how do you develop a sense of humor about the fact that as you become more and more aware, what you tend to see is how much grasping there is and how much aversion there is and how much confusion there is? I think that's a really good question, you know. And I think it happens in different ways. And they're just like lots of skillful means that accomplish what is in effect a state of balance, because to be funny about something or have a sense of humor about it implies a kind of balance. And I was just saying today, I often say that I sometimes map the trajectory of my progress in practice as having been one where in the beginning of my meditation practice for a number of different reasons. I was very shocked by a lot of what came up in my mind. I was kind of horrified a lot. I wasn't familiar so much with my inner state, and I was kind of young and unsophisticated in many ways, and so I was just appalled a lot of the time. In fact, I was telling these people that I'm somewhat famous in my community of friends from that time for having once marched up to my first teacher and saying to him, "I never used to be an angry person before I started to meditate," you know, thereby laying blame squarely where I felt it belonged, which was on him. And of course, I had been hugely angry, but I hadn't been aware of it. So I almost map the progress I've made in terms of my reaction to those states. You know, I've gone from being so upset and so horrified and taking it so personally to almost more a kind of rueful amusement. It's like, oh, you again, you know, look at that. And in fact, there's in Tibetan teaching, they sometimes use the example saying, you should look at the thoughts that arise in your mind as though you were quite an elderly person sitting in a playground watching children play. And I like that example so much because of the kind of tenderness it implies. You know, it's not like you look at the kids and you think, you idiot, it's just a shovel, you know? Like, what are you doing, you know? But you also don't fall into the drama of it. Like, oh my God, the shovel, you know? It's like you see it for what it is with the perspective of maturity, not being lost in it. But it's so tender, you know? It's like you're watching these children play. And so, like, what I was saying is that there are lots of skillful means to try to develop that. Loving-kindness practice, you know, loving-kindness for yourself, or really reflecting on the fact that you do not have control and you will not have control over what arises in your mind. And that's not kind of the point of practice anyway. It's much more to the point of, the point is much more transforming one's relationship to what has come up, rather than feeling, oh, well, if I, you know, squelch it, you know, it'll never come back. But to really work with that, and even I use this example when I was teaching this weekend. Joseph has a kind of instruction he sometimes suggests to people, which is, especially if you're in sitting, you know, you're meditating in a room full of people, you should regard the thoughts that arise in your mind as though they're arising in the mind of the person sitting next to you. And you can practice that even if there's nobody sitting next to you. You can just sort of transpose that. And I think I find that very interesting because all of a sudden that ferocity of reaction, like, you idiot, you're thinking that again, you're vile, you know, changes to, wow, look at what you're thinking. You poor person, you know. Look at what road you're taking, you know, or come back. Don't go down that road, you know. But it's a very different perspective. And so whatever means works for you, I think that is the point, is to have a more loving, more accepting, more wise response. You know, the love and the acceptance doesn't imply a kind of dullness, like, oh yeah, you know, who cares? Because it's powerful, it's important. But it's a different kind of caring. Okay, I think we need to stop.